From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, tens of thousands of pro-democracy protesters gather in Hong Kong, defying calls to disperse following multiple arrests and a strong police response.
The line coming from Beijing that this is outside influence, it's not. It's the people of Hong Kong have been effectively lied to.
Also today, we look at the two women vying for presidential glory in this year's Brazilian elections. And as President Obama admits the White House underestimated the IS threat, we look at the UK's military role against the militants.
They're in operation over Iraq. They're there to gather intelligence. They're there in close support. They're there to deter ISIL.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The White House says it supports the democratic aspirations of protesters in Hong Kong, but urges peace between riot police and demonstrators. Authorities are clashing with tens of thousands of protesters in Hong Kong as the demonstrators demand an uncensored electoral process and refuse to leave public spaces. White House spokesperson Josh Earnest said the Obama administration is closely watching the situation. He also said the White House believes an open society with universal suffrage is critical for Hong Kong's success. Mr. Earnest said U.S. leaders have made their position clear to authorities in Beijing and will continue to do so. He urged for calm in the streets of Hong Kong.
The United States urges the Hong Kong authorities to exercise restraint and for protesters to express their views peacefully. The United States supports universal suffrage in Hong Kong in accordance with the basic law, and we support the aspirations of the Hong Kong people.
The United States is congratulating Afghanistan's new leaders following the inauguration of the country's president. Ashraf Ghani was sworn in following a prolonged dispute over the election results with his rival Abdullah Abdullah, who gets the new post of chief executive. As Malcolm Brown reports from Washington, the U.S. is now hoping for the prompt signing of a deal which would allow some American troops to remain in the country after the deadline for the withdrawal of American forces.
There's relief here that Afghanistan's post-election wrangling is over and hope that the inauguration marks a new start. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has congratulated Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah, calling them patriots committed to the success of their country. The departure of former President Hamid Karzai, with whom Washington had an extremely fractious relationship, clears the way for the signing of a long-delayed deal on foreign forces staying on after 2014. The expectation is that the so-called Status of Forces Agreement would be signed within 24 hours of President Ghani's swearing in.
As the United Nations General Assembly continues, there have been renewed calls to reform the UN, in particular the UN Security Council. Here's Nick Harper from New York.
Geopolitics have changed much since the UN's creation in 1945, but the UN Security Council has altered relatively little. Calls for reform are not uncommon, especially in the public arena of the annual UN General Assembly. With 5 permanent seats and 10 rotating on the 15-member Security Council, India, Brazil, Germany and Japan all want to be added to the permanent list. And African countries, including South Africa, Kenya and Angola, who are likely to replace Rwanda on the council next year, lament the lack of permanent representation from the African continent.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Studies in the U.S. estimate 1 in 5 women is sexually assaulted while at university. In an attempt to curb these assaults, the governor of the state of California, Jerry Brown, has signed a landmark bill called Yes Means Yes, the first state bill to require students to have clear, active consent before all sexual activity. David Leonard has more from California.
The Yes Means Yes legislation, also known as SB 967, is the first U.S. state law to make the language of affirmative consent a central principle of school sexual assault policies. The law applies to all California post-secondary schools, public and private, that receive state money for student financial aid. Yes Means No stipulates that voluntary agreements rather than the lack of resistance defines consent. However, critics say the new law dangerously expands the definition of assault. Under the bill, someone who is drunk, drugged, unconscious, or asleep cannot grant consent.
And Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov has said that any potential expansion by NATO into former Yugoslav republics could be seen by Russia as a provocation. Montenegro, Macedonia, and Bosnia have all expressed willingness to join the Western military alliance, following the path of fellow former Yugoslav Republic Croatia, which became a member of NATO in 2009. Jake Rashbass reports from Moscow.
In a newspaper interview, the Russian foreign minister said that the integration of the former Yugoslav republics into NATO would be a mistake that would undermine the determination to build a system of equal and shared security in Europe. Mr. Lavrov's latest statements come amid the greatest tension between Russia and NATO since the Cold War. The Kremlin announced earlier this month that Russia would be updating its military doctrine in light of the sharp deterioration in relations with NATO.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Tens of thousands of pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong are defying calls to disperse after extending their protests into the working week. On Sunday, the police used tear gas and batons to try to halt the momentum of a movement seeking a free and open leadership election process. As more people joined in the protests, police responded by withdrawing from their dispersal tactics. The pro-democracy camp is alarmed by rules which would enable a committee to control the nominations process and exclude candidates not favoured by Beijing. Tony Harding is an independent broadcaster based in Hong Kong.
Several years ago, Hong Kong was handed back to China, and as part of that, Mrs. Thatcher negotiated a settlement with the Chinese government, and that settlement included a basic law and a provision that by 2017, which would be 20 years after the handback, the people of Hong Kong could elect their leader. Now, negotiations for this have been going on for some time. Exactly how this should be done, it was to be one man, one vote. But the Chinese government, who signed this treaty, have one view of it and one view of what one man, one vote means. And the Democrats and most of the people in Hong Kong have a different view. So the government in Beijing have come down and said that for a start, there must be a large committee which will nominate whoever is to stand in the election. And more than 50% of them have to agree to a candidate. So a candidate has to find 50% of these people to be put forward to vote. Mm-hmm. And so this has been seen by the Democrats in Hong Kong as a way to stop a Democrat being elected. They would just make sure that only people approved by Beijing get on the ballot, and this has caused uproar. So now people are protesting in the streets.
Okay, so those people who are chasing free and fair elections in 2017, I mean, what sort of numbers are we talking about, and what sort of people are joining the ranks there and making up those crowds?
This started out as a student-led campaign, rather as some of us may remember from Paris in the 1960s and other uprisings. But really, you can see people of all ages. My own wife, if we weren't going away, wanted to go there. People from all walks of life. And there are more people there than just students. So it's a wide cross-section. People are going along, and from the middle of the day today, the main protest area was well populated, but there were gaps. By the time we got to 4 o'clock, it was really filling up, and now it's just coming up to 10 o'clock, and all of the protest areas are extremely packed.
Mm-hmm. Is this a peaceful protest? Have the police had to have been involved?
It's been peaceful on the protesters' side. Last night, the police, well, yesterday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, the police started firing tear gas into the crowds, and there have been some reports by the protesters that rubber bullets were used. Armed police turned up carrying rifles, but they have been pulled out, and at the moment it's the police seem to be just standing and looking. But the reaction to yesterday's events have fallen naturally along two lines. Those who support Beijing have said that it's wholly acceptable and understandable, and the people who, the democratic side, have said this is unconscionable. Mm-hmm. No, that's the wrong word. Is completely unacceptable. And today the president of Taiwan has even weighed in on the side of the Democrats and said that he will push Beijing to enter into talks. But Beijing government has said to the protesters that that's it. What we have decided is what will happen, and the pro-Beijing parties in Hong Kong have said, oh, you shouldn't protest like this, you should enter into dialogue. Mm-hmm. To which the Democrats say, well, there's no point in entering into dialogue because Beijing has said they will not change their mind.
Okay, so Hong Kong authorities, they have asked the protesters to sort of disperse and do so peacefully. China has said they won't bend, but they must be looking on with some discomfort here, because isn't there a chance that perhaps these protests could spill over into the mainland? Is that a fear that you're getting out of Beijing?
No, I think Beijing are more scared that there is the Communist Party of China's theme has always been that they are the only people who can hold China together, stop it falling apart, can stop all sorts of things. They are the only people that can do it, and they really don't want there to be a chance that somebody else might be able to do it. Channel News Asia, the broadcaster out of Singapore, put up on their website today a piece about this and included a YouTube video, mm-hmm. which from an ordinary girl in Hong Kong standing talking to the camera. And the remarks from people on the mainland, who strangely are not allowed to see YouTube, right. but they still managed to comment anyway, was quite vitriolic, accusing everybody of being paid for by the CIA and things like that. That's the line coming from Beijing, that this is outside influence. It's not. It's the people of Hong Kong have been effectively lied to. They were told you can have one man, one vote, you can decide who your leader is, mm-hmm. and they see that as not being what they're being given and are protesting.
Tony Harding, an independent broadcaster based in Hong Kong. This is FSN Reports. President Obama has admitted in a CBS News interview that America has underestimated the threat of the Islamic State militants. The US leader said his administration failed to acknowledge the Syrian civil conflict had allowed the jihadist group to reorganize and spread their forces through Iraq. Britain's military has now joined the anti-IS coalition, flying combat missions in Iraq. Vladimir van Wildenberg is a journalist in Erbil, northern Iraq, and he told LBC's Lisa Aziz that the expanding air campaign is welcome news in the region.
Kurds are quite happy with the airstrikes because it will assure them that the IS, the Islamic State group, will never be a threat to them again.
Lots of calls here, though, meanwhile, Vladimir, that airstrikes alone, they're not enough, that any proper defeat of IS is just going to absolutely need ground forces. Is that what Iraqis in the key area where you are, is that what they want to see? And also, just bring us up to date on the humanitarian situation there.
Well, in Iraq, maybe in Syria, that's a big problem. But in Iraq, there is a government, and there's now a reconciliation process between the different communities. It's going to be a longer process with the new government now in place. But in Iraq, there's somehow a process to bridge those differences, unlike in Syria, where there's an ongoing civil war with no real conciliation between Assad and rebel groups. But here in Iraq, the situation is different. And on the humanitarian scale, there has been thousands of refugees streaming into in northern Iraq in the Kurdistan region. If I just walk through the streets here close to my house, there's refugees in the school nearby. And the local government here, the local Kurdish government, is really struggling with providing those displaced people with aid and with food and shelter.
Journalist and analyst Vladimir van Wildenberg in Erbil, northern Iraq. The involvement of the UK military in the anti-IS campaign has come in for some criticism over its efficacy and whether enough is being done to defeat the Islamic State fighters in Iraq. Nick Ferrari tackled these concerns with UK Defence Secretary Michael Fallon.
Well, let's just be very clear. The RAF have not failed. The RAF do not fail. They're in operation over Iraq. They're there to gather intelligence. They're there in close support. They're there to deter ISIL. They're there in partnership with the Iraqi forces and the Kurdish forces in the effort now to drive back ISIL out of Iraq. Now, sometimes that'll mean they'll find some fixed targets and go in and destroy them, but that isn't simply what they're doing. They're also working in support, working alongside the ground forces in what is going to be a long, drawn-out campaign.
It's interesting you say that, because you're quoted in one of the newspapers this morning, Mr. Fallon. This is not going to be a weekend, a war over a weekend. What sort of duration do you put on it?
Oh, certainly weeks and months. ISIL have got right into western and northern Iraq. They've got quite close to Baghdad. And our job now is to help the new government of Iraq drive them out. And that means air cover, working in support of ground forces. There are going to be combat troops on the ground, but they're Iraqi combat troops on the ground. And what we're doing with a lot of allies in the region is providing the close air support they will need to push ISIL out of the towns and villages that they've captured and to keep pushing them back towards the border. And that is going to take weeks, and that may well take months.
And what happens when they vanish over the border, Mr. Fallon?
Well, they're back in Syria, and we've made it clear that ISIL has to be defeated in both countries, and that's why we support the airstrikes that the Americans and others have done in Syria, where their command and control is. A lot of their equipment is based, and that's where they're getting their money. They're using oil refineries there. So there are more targets. There are more targets for airstrikes in Syria than there are in Iraq. But the RAF Tornadoes are playing a vital role in backing up the Iraqi forces. So it is quite wrong to suggest that they have somehow failed. I can tell you that the Tornadoes that flew last night returned safely in the early hours of this morning. But they all each of these missions is in support of the Iraqi forces, and each of them so far is successful.
Some members of former members of military top brass have stepped forward to say this isn't fully thought out, you're not doing enough. How would you respond?
Well, we've been working there for 6-7 weeks now. We've not just arrived. We've been supplying humanitarian aid to the refugees, dropping water and other supplies from 450 feet in a very hostile environment. We've been ferrying ammunition and arms to the Kurdish forces, who've been really up against it with ISIL. The RAF has been hard at work all summer. Now, we've not until last Friday had the authority of Parliament to get involved in direct military action. But we're going to be doing that now, as I said, in support of the Iraqi forces.
Is it right that Denmark have sent more aircraft than the United Kingdom?
Denmark has sent, I think, 6 or 7 aircraft. We have 6 Tornadoes out there. They're flying in pairs. A number of air forces are contributing, but it isn't just the number of aircraft you send. We're there anyway. We have our base at Akrotiri. We have other bases in the Gulf. We've been present in the Middle East a lot longer than Denmark. The other allies are very welcome, and they will all be joining in. This is an international effort.
Got enough kit?
Yes, there are enough Tornadoes. We have Tornadoes at work, by the way, in Afghanistan. They're also searching for the missing Nigerian schoolgirls down in West Africa. But there are more Tornadoes back in the United Kingdom, and we will rotate the squadron we have out at Akrotiri to make sure the planes and the crews are properly rested. But there are enough aircraft for the mission.
So this is more of a counter-terrorism initiative than it is a war?
Yes, I mean it's a bit of both, but certainly ISIL are a terrorist, you know, have been using terrorist tactics in the towns and villages, and it's going to take time to dislodge them, which can only be done by ground troops, village by village, town by town. Eventually we've got to help the Iraqi forces get them out of Mosul, which is the big town they captured, and that's going to be difficult, dangerous work, but that's where air support comes in.
Do you know the identity of Jihadi John?
We don't discuss anything to do with the British hostages, I'm afraid, for very good reasons. We're not in negotiation with them. We don't want to give them that kind of benefit or status. What I can tell you, Nick, is we are working constantly to try and identify where the remaining hostages are being held. If there's any chance at all of coming to their aid, I can promise you we will do that.
LBC's Nick Ferrari talking to UK Defence Secretary Michael Fallon. This is FSN Reports. Finally, tonight, FSN Spotlight turns its attention to this year's presidential election contest in Brazil, where two women are leading the race for the top seat, the incumbent Dilma Rousseff and an upstart candidate Marina Silva. Ms. Silva shot to the top of the polls after she became Socialist Party candidate last month, following the death of its previous presidential hopeful, Eduardo Campos. Joe Leahy, FT correspondent in Sao Paulo, discussed the two rival candidates with Fiona Simon, beginning with Marina Silva.
She has a very compelling life story. She's the daughter of poor rubber tappers who grew up in the Amazon. She was illiterate until she was 16 years old, and then she took herself to the local city in the state of Acre and taught herself to read, and then went on to get a degree in history. So she has that background, a background that a lot of Brazilians, millions in fact, could recognise. And she went on from there to work with Chico Mendes, a very famous environmentalist in Brazil opposing deforestation. And she eventually joined the Senate, joined the PT, the Workers' Party, and became Environment Minister. And during her time as Environment Minister, she had a lot of success in reducing the deforestation of the Amazon, which is an achievement that actually ranks in terms of a global achievement. So she's someone who has come from a very humble background, which a lot of Brazilians can identify with, and has used education to get herself to the very heights of power.
How does this record compare with the achievements and failings of the Dilma presidency?
Dilma also has a very compelling life story, but it's a life story that belongs a little bit to the past. She was a former guerrilla. She fought the dictatorship in Brazil, which ended in 1984. And she belongs to a generation of leftist politicians who struggled against the military of that time. Her achievements have been a great concern for social welfare. She has launched a lot of programs, extended the Bolsa Família, the Brazilian social welfare program in which the government pays a monthly stipend to families in exchange for sending their children to school and making sure they get health checks. It's an incredibly successful program, and Ms. Rousseff has pushed this program and extended it. On the other hand, on the economic front, she's introduced a sort of a more command and control style of management, a very centralized micromanagement style that has been criticized for being unproductive and for actually winding back the clock a little bit in terms of the way the economy here has been running. So we've seen interference to control the price of fuel, interference to control interest rates, all of these sort of old-style Latin American ways of running the economy that have been largely discredited over the years. These have come back, and as a result, we've seen a lot of negative sentiment among investors against the Dilma government.
Which is the preferred candidate of the business community in Brazil?
It's by far at this stage Marina Silva, and that's because Marina, although she combines this life story that identifies very much with the poorer elements of society, she has on her side a group of economic advisers who are advising her to return to a more orthodox form of management of the economy, to target much more inflation, to try to keep the fiscal deficit under control, which has been a failing of the Dilma government, according to her critics. And these economic advisers are very trusted by the market, and there's a view that if she comes in, she may be able to deliver a positive shock in the first year to bring inflation back down towards the centre of the target, to balance the budget and start reducing public debt. And by the second year of her term, economic growth and investment could return. Marina Silva is promising a more of a high-level style presidency. She'll leave a lot of the economic management to professionals. She's talking about making the central bank officially independent. At the moment, it has unofficial autonomy. She wants to introduce a rule that will give the central bank president a fixed mandate that cannot be changed by an incoming president. In the case of Dilma, she is an economist herself, and there's a joke in Sao Paulo that the real finance minister in Brazil is actually Dilma, because she takes a great interest in managing the economy and in introducing her own measures. And as we've discussed, these include price controls and unorthodox ways of trying to control inflation and stimulate industry.
Do you think there are any particular issues that could swing the electorate in either direction? And what do the polls show as the election looms on October the 5th?
The key concern among voters is, at the moment, they've come through a period of 12 years of a P2 rule. It would be difficult to argue that they're not better off than they were before. But they want change. They're tired of having poor hospitals, poor education, poor public services. So the key issue is, what do they stand to lose by changing? Now, we've seen Dilma wage a campaign to try to convince voters that a change with Marina would be a change for the worse, that it would be a step into the unknown, that her pro-market policies would lead to less food on their tables. And she has, for this campaign, she's come back quite strongly in the polls. And now the polls are showing that in the second round runoff of the election will probably go to two rounds, and the first round is on October the 5th and the second on October the 26th. It looks like in the second round at the moment that they're both evenly matched, and before Marina was ahead. So this scare campaign by Dilma is having its effect. The key thing will be, between the first and second rounds, they'll both have the same amount of free advertising time on television. And this will be the time when Marina Silva will have to try to convince voters that the change will be safe and that she will preserve the gains that they have made over the past 12 years under the PT.
What will be the biggest task facing whoever does win the presidential election?
The biggest task will be, in the initial phases, to win back the trust of the markets. Whoever wins is going to have to make some very tough choices on the budget and the economy. The first thing will be to get the budget back into a what they call a primary surplus. This is the surplus before interest rate payments, which at the moment is below the level where it needs to be to stop the government from accumulating more debt. Brazil's debt levels are reasonably comfortable, but it can't afford to be complacent because interest rates in Brazil are incredibly high. So if the debt levels go up, then the debt payments in the budget become unaffordable. So the next president will have to get this primary surplus up, and that will mean some tough choices on the budget. Something is going to have to be cut, and that's going to be an incredibly difficult decision. And the other big challenge will be to change the microeconomic environment to attract more investment. Brazil has to recover the confidence of investors and get them to start investing more, particularly in infrastructure, because Brazil has supply bottlenecks at almost every level of the economy.
So who would you put your money on?
At this stage, I think it's 50-50. I think Marina Silva was leading in the past couple of weeks, but we'll have to see a much more effective campaign from her, I think, in the coming few weeks if she's going to win. I think at the moment, Dilma has the momentum.
Joe Leahy, FT correspondent in Sao Paulo, talking to Fiona Simon. And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email us reports@featurestory.com. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.